Once upon a time in the West, in honor of Once Upon a Deadpool, what R-rated movie is just some added bookend scenes away from needing a PG-13 cut?
I'm Katie Rich, and I still barely know what Once Upon a Deadpool is, but I would watch a PG-13 version of Mad Max Fury Road.
I am Matt Patches, and in this horrible world where movies are censored or not and forced to live beyond the R rating and kids don't get to see them, I wouldn't mind an 8th grade edited to PG-13 standards. Gucci.
Hey, it's me, Dave, with the 7, and I'm going to go with a movie that was already edited for content and say, why not just go all the way with Eyes Wide Shut and change the argument he had with his wife to something PG-13 friendly, like he thawed the chicken wrong, and he has to go find her.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I definitely think Patches has the most like relevant of the answers in that the movie shouldn't have been rated R in the first place, but given my understanding of what Once Upon a Time in a Deadpool is, I would love to see them try and do the same thing to Reservoir Dogs, just to see what that would end up looking like.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 242, and it's the week of Wednesday, December 12th, the day that in 1977, Saturday Night Fever premiered. Isn't that a summer movie? Isn't that a weird thing to have premiered in December? I've never seen it.
I mean, I imagine it would be, but I don't know how movie premieres worked. Like,
why is that
in the 70s?
It just seems like a movie that you would want to watch in the summer.
No, it's a movie where you want to come in from the cold. You want to hit the dance floor, the warm dance floor.
I think if I remember looking up this fact, this is also the time of like bi-coastal premieres. So this would be the New York premiere of Saturday Night Fever.
No, it's when you've got a fever, you get in a bathtub full of ice, you know?
The only cure is chill Saturday out. Night. before we get started, I hear we have some reviews.
We have two reviews. They both look kind of short. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Fine Italian Pants says, ooh, some love for Ehrlich.
Ooh,
I like where
some.
This is going. I'm already going to say that this review was helpful even before I start reading it because it has helped my self-esteem. And that's what needs help more than anything else. It means I get to go easier on my therapist this week. Fine Italian Pants says, I feel like a lot of these reviews call out David or whatever, so I just want to say that I love this podcast and all of its hosts. I also want to shout out Madeline's Madeline, which I finally watched on Amazon Prime and absolutely loved. Thanks for reading this on air. Keep up the good podcast. Yes, go read or go watch, rather, Madeline's Madeline on Amazon Prime or wherever you might find it. Real good. It will, I can guarantee, come up on at least one of our year-end lists when we record our best 2018 episode.
My plan is to watch it before we record that.
Is it mine?
It's Patches. and Darby Act says, amazing, great film podcast. 5 stars. It's year 3 of my annual rating of one of the best podcasts in all of the world. Hashtag no hyperbole. Hashtag it's wonderful. Hashtag do hashtags work on iTunes reviews. Hashtag... you can't fight in here. It's a podcaster. The R key at the end there instead of the T. But the good news is that hashtags don't work on iTunes, so it doesn't matter one way or the other. P.S. I greatly dislike SpongeBob, but I miss the dubstep SpongeBob song more than Paddington misses Aunt Lucy. Was this review helpful? Sure. It taught us all that hashtags don't work on the iTunes store.
Yeah.
We've been an entire year of I Love Lucy theme instead of dubstep SpongeBob, and just a few weeks before I was thinking maybe it was permanent. You know what? Maybe we need to bring back dubstep SpongeBob.
Or something totally new. Keep people on their toes.
Fair. Let's find out.
It's the dream. Oh!
Start.
So, Katie, what would you say if I told you that there is a Spider-Man movie coming out This upcoming week, on December 14th in the United States, it's a Spider-Man movie that will tell you 6 new origin stories for Spider-Man, and I promise you, you will love every second of those 6 origin stories.
What a sell!
Can I tell you what I know about Into the Spider-Verse?
Please do.
I know that Miles Morales is involved, and I know who Miles Morales is because of you, from the comics. I know that there is a Spider-Ham involved, so presumably there are multiple Spider-Mans.
Peter Parker.
Phil Lord and Chris Miller are involved somehow. And that's literally all I got.
Spider beings, please.
Correct.
Yeah.
Into the Spider-Verse is Sony Animation's first animated Spider-Man film. This was something that was announced way back while the Marvel-Sony deal was being made to share Spider-Man. Back at the day, it looked like they were going to split into Avi Arad and Matt Tolomak, the two amazing Spider-Man producers. They were going to let them sort of cool off and do their own thing. That produced Venom, which ended up being wildly successful. So that little side of the Spider-Verse kicked into gear. And then this little animated movie, which initially looked like a way to sort of allow Miles Morales to grow into a IP of his own that Sony then could exploit while live-action Peter Parker was over in the Marvel Universe, actually decided to open the entire Spider-Man property by introducing a multiverse as part of Miles Morales' origin story. So in the comics, in the ultimate version of the comics, Peter Parker dies in a fight with the Green Goblin defending Aunt May, and another boy with spider powers, a black Puerto Rican Brooklyn 13-year-old, who is going to a special school called Visions Academy, gets bit by a spider, and is inspired by Peter Parker to become the next Spider-Man. The movie actually sticks pretty close to that plot while introducing older alternative universe Peter Parker in his 40s, who has been divorced from Mary Jane, as sort of the mentor to this younger Miles Morales.
And he's voiced by Jake Johnson of New Girl fame. And so you can imagine what that sounds like.
And kids love divorcees.
Yeah. And he's essentially playing Nick from New Girl. Yes. It's a pretty inspired pairing.
And so while he's trying to teach Miles how to be Spider-Man, and they're trying to get him back to his own dimension, they stumble across a number of other spider people who have also been stranded because
spider
of these
beings. Please spider show some beings. Respect. It's 2018.
Spider beings. Yeah, I mean, I guess we could. One of the things that I love about Spider-Ham being in this movie is they actually keep his original origin, which is that he's a spider that was bitten by a radioactive pig and then turned into a pig with spider powers. So that's plus Spider-Man Noir, played by Nick Cage, and a Penny Parker and her mecha robot spider. She's a Japanese teenager from the future who has a mental link with a spider that controls a mechanized robot. And then Peter Parker all team up to take on the Kingpin, who has this Hadron Collider. It's not really important. The important thing is that this movie is much like it's a Phil Lord movie in the sense that it moves about at the pace of the Lego Movie or Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs in terms of joke to plot being divided. Almost.
Not quite at that breakneck speed, but almost. It has a lot more heavy lifting to do universe building wise.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. And then it also is like a movie that deals with like the death of one Spider-Man and like some could be serious issues like the divorce with Mary Jane or what, you know, if some Spider-Men live like long enough to see more of their loved ones die. It deals with all those very fast and in a very quippy manner that allows it to sort of be centered around Miles Morales' character and allows the moral of it to sort of be about being Spider-Man and that everybody can be their own type of Spider-Man. And I think one of the things that makes Into the Spider-Verse a really good Spider-Man movie, despite the fact that it's beautiful as an animated movie, is this is the first Spider-Man movie that's about being Spider-Man. It's not about being Peter Parker, white teenager in Queens. And I think the movie really benefits from having that breathing room, but is really going to pay dividends if it gets more animated sequels in this vein, and if it could market the idea that anyone could be a Spider-Man. I think that's the ultimate Spider-Man fan goal. But David, you saw this movie and liked this movie, and then were part of the New York Critics Film Circle that gave it the best animated feature of the year. So what did you like about
David
Spider-Verse?
Likes superhero movies now.
Yeah.
Let's not go quite that far. But I was very proud to be in the New York Film Critics Circle that awarded this. We were the first critics body, I will have you know, that awarded this the best animated film of the year. I triumphed over the likes
of good job.
Incredibles 2. Thank
we're
you.
We're also the first critics body to vote.
That's besides the point. Whoopee. We set the precedent. We laid the groundwork for LA to follow suit. Who knows if those clods over in Los Angeles, who are 3 hours behind everyone else, would have had the same wisdom, not been for us. Phil Lord and Chris Miller make good movies. They are clever boys, and they have a sense of humor that I find really agreeable. But what I really loved about this movie, which is, certainly, and it's sickening to hear people say this is the best Spider-Man movie because it's like such Spider-Man 2 erasure. I don't even know where to begin, but it is a close second. It's a really wonderful movie, and I think one of the things about it is that the way Dave described it to Katie, had I heard that before I saw the movie, I would have rolled my eyes out of my spider head and all eight of them, and it would have been really gross because it sounds like the last thing the world needs is another origin movie, and actually the last thing the world needs specifically is another Spider-Man origin story. And this is a movie about that very explicitly. From the moment it begins, it confronts the idea that we have seen more Spider-Man origin stories, even those of us who don't read comics, than a single person in a single lifetime should have to contain. And the movie has great fun with that idea, but it also becomes a movie about the value of origin stories and what they can be when we are not sick of them, and the opportunities that they offer to people who we need to become heroes. And we wouldn't necessarily, or the comic industry and movies have not put front and center and put made into heroes, and that sort of need these stories to find their way and assume the mantle of strength and responsibility and power, responsibility, the great power that comes with it, and even greater responsibility, and so on. And this movie finds a very manic, clever, endlessly clever way of doing that. And it looks really cool. I mean, it's like a giant sort of souffle, or not a souffle, that's the wrong, I'm bad, I should never use a cooking analogy, I don't have the right, but it's like a stir fry of animated influences.
A goulash.
And there's like a million different
it's
things
a
going
slow
on.
Slow cook chili, you started at like 10 a.m.
David, did you get to see it in 3D?
No. And
I'd be really interested. I'd be really interested to see if that's like a step too far, because you're right in the sense that there is like dozens of animation techniques going on simultaneously at some points in this film.
And that works thematically, I think. I mean, it's a bold choice. I think there are a lot of bold choices made, you know, invested in a movie that, I think the movie was a little bit of a risk compared to at least other superhero movies, probably guaranteed some sort of return on investment, but I think that they were getting into new territory here. But it's very thematically on point that they have all these different styles. I think the one choice that I'm still not entirely sure about is the decision to animate it on ones rather than twos, which is what we are used to seeing.
On twos rather than ones.
That's what I meant to say. I always get that wrong. Which means that we are seeing... Dave, help me out here. We are seeing two...
So it's going to look more like stop motion to your eye because none of the effects are based on actual 24 frames per second lens effects. So all the CGI and stuff that you see, like Incredibles 2 as a good example of this, what they're actually doing is replicating a real film camera in a digital environment. This is not that. This is much more like stop motion where they want to have control over all of the frame, even to the point where in order for have something to have be out of focus, they're separating the color channels a little bit, and it looks a little bit more like a 3D effect that isn't working when you're not having glasses on. They're not actually blurring the image.
It's 12 drawings every frame rather than the American industry standard of 24.
I mean, yes, you're gonna. In terms of cinematic animation, yes, the 24 frames per second is going to be industry standard.
It's standard here. I mean, if you're used to watching anime is also for the most part done on twos.
Anime is sometimes even done on the threes.
Right, with the low budget stuff, I would imagine. But Yeah, and this is and the reason that they do that here is so it can contribute to the idea of watching a graphic novel. I mean, there are so many things, more than any other movie this side of Scott Pilgrim, that are done to accentuate the graphic novelishness of those frames. You see there are dialogue boxes at times, there are visualized sound effects, there are crazy transitions. It reminds me a lot of Ang Lee's Hulk in that way. And the idea of animating it on twos is that it slows down every frame so you can appreciate all of them on their own. I think it does lead to a slightly stilted effect, but the movie, I think, is told at such a speed that it compensates for that. But I'll say before I hand the baton, because I've been talking for way too long, that I think the weakest part of this movie is, unfortunately, all the stuff with Miles' family. I think they really sell his relationship with his dad and his uncle short. I think that the movie works best and actually becomes surprisingly poignant and like has a real emotional undertow to it, regarding when he meets the other spider beings. And I think like the idea between all of them, that they all feel this sense of being different and alone, and they have this short-lived relationship that won't be able to sustain itself when they all go back to their universes eventually, is really touching. And all of the spider beings, even John Mulaney, who they understand, who sucks generally, in my opinion, and I don't like his stand-up. I know he's written things that I think are hilarious, but his stand-up rubs me the wrong way. But they understand, because Lord and Miller and all the directors here, there are three credited directors, are very, very smart, and they understand a character like Peter Porker works best in small portions, like Bacon. And he only has a handful of lines in the movie, and they're all funny. But Spider-Man Noir, Nick Cage, chef's kiss, brilliant. Penny Parker, her adorable little spider, amazing. Haley Steinfeld as Spider Girl, I want to say, is that her name?
Spider-Gwen.
It depends if you're... The interesting thing is a whole bunch of these teasers include either footage or alternate line readings or alternate takes that are not in the movie.
Huh.
That's not the interesting thing, but it's it's all comes together very, very, very well. They're... Unfortunately, the scenes between them are few and far between. It's really only in the second half of the movie, but it's really, really strong stuff. I think that this is a really fresh and reinvigorating take on superhero movies, and not a minute.
And David's ready to see every other Spider-Man movie coming out soon, and he's excited for Aquaman.
I am too.
Here
we go.
He loves,
I don't
want to
talk about
again.
It, but I'm excited, albeit in a small, reluctant way, for the next full-blown Spider-Man movie. Not because of this entirely, but maybe this did a little bit to help my excitement. The Avengers Endgame may as well be like a fucking tetanus shot in my eyeball. Like, I cannot... I know I'm going to have to suffer through that, but I'm not looking forward to it. But a smaller scale post-Avengers MCU Spider-Man movie with like Jake Gyllenhaal and whatever, I'm down. Aunt May's back. Sure.
Everyone declare victory and go home. Dave is excited for a superhero movie.
No, you guys don't. Go on.
Earlier this year, Katie, I think it may have been just you and me at this point, but we talked about The Good Place, a show that we adore, a show that seems to be like the only network sitcom that any of us are watching or people are talking about, and it came back for season 3, and I think we were kind of like weirdly...
And just got renewed for season 4.
It's coming back again, which is astonishing. I guess people watch it, or it has enough prestige, and maybe people catch it on Hulu wherever it streams. It comes to Netflix in season batches eventually. People have found the show, this sitcom from Mike Schur, starring Kristen Bell and Ted Danson and all these schmucks. We talked about it at the beginning of the season 3, and I think we were kind of like in the middle on it. Maybe that wasn't as satisfying for people who, I mean, if you're listening to this mini segment, you are all the way caught up. We're going full spoilers on the mid-season finale, because that's a thing that people do now.
Yeah, we haven't seen anything ahead. We've only seen what's aired.
Correct. We're going to talk up through the 10th episode, and you know exactly what we're talking about if you're listening to this. So season 3, all of our friends are now back in the real world. They're living their real lives, and it's up to Ted Danson character's Michael, the kind of architect of the good place or the bad place, to bring these people back together in hopes that they can rejigger their lives in a way to get them to the good place. And over the course of this season, we haven't been in the fantastical world of the good place. We've mostly been talking about the life choices of these characters and seeing if they could connect in an emotional way. And then in the back half, after we had our little conversation earlier in the season, things got really fantastical because the main crew discovered that Michael was an angel and that there was a good place and a bad place and this whole magical world that they could potentially control. And of course, all the people, all the judgment people of the bad place are coming after Michael from the other side of this plane of existence. And it's just wacky. And I want to talk about this last episode because, my God, if I was in the middle on season three, I think that this was an astonishing piece of work that makes use of everything that's incredible about The Good Place, which is here's a show that can take all of its characters and make none of them appear in the mid-season finale and basically take place in a white void. What I love is how this show bends its budget. And this is a weird thing to think about, but if you spend a lot of time thinking about like production and how a show on ABC or no, on NBC can have big budget special effects and then all of a sudden be like in a bottle episode contained in one room. Here's an episode that takes place in a white void for the most part. And I thought this whole thing was astonishing and the setup here. And I want to hear what you guys think about this and if it turned anything around for you. The quick setup is that Janet has sucked up everybody into her place. What is she? Does she call it a void?
Her void. She calls it her void.
Yes. Which is basically her head, where all her information is stored. And when they appear in her void, they all appear as Janet. So the actress, D'Arcy Carden, gets to play Eleanor and Chidi and Tahani, and Jason. And it is hilarious. Running amok is there trying to like make sure that the void isn't imploding, because they're losing their identities, and that may hinge on the void. But Janet gets to play all of these characters while Michael, Ted Danson's character, tries to figure out if he realizes that no one has been admitted to the good place in like 500 years or something.
Yeah, he's working on a theory that the bad place has been manipulating the data, which I didn't remember that happening. Like, that's plot development that I had just forgotten about from whatever's the last time we saw.
What's his name from The Office is in this episode too. Stephen Merchant. It plays somebody in like accounting in the afterlife who is collecting all this information. That's not the best part of this episode. The best part is that D'Arcy Carden is apparently an incredible actress who could play all these types of people. And I just thought it was so astonishing. What did you guys think of the finale of The Good Place?
It was great.
It's so good.
I guess we did talk about like wondering like where they were going to go with the story since they were no longer in the good place or the bad place or anywhere, but they were back on Earth. And it was interesting kind of watching them get into this plot of like, they wanted to like heal their friends and family and like help them get into the good place. But it just keeps shifting of what the show is about, which I think is really exciting, but also makes it really hard for me. Like, I feel like I can never judge it and say whether or not the good place is being good or bad, because I just enjoy watching it twist itself around so much from episode to episode.
It cannot be good or bad. It has to be something in between. It has to be something itself.
It is entirely itself. D'Arcy Carden was amazing. I really like the Eleanor and Chidi romance and the way that
that's what I want to ask.
And how that like became such a great emotional hook at the end. I thought the end of the episode was really moving, which The Good Place doesn't often find itself to. Like, there's elements of heart to it, but it's not like, you know, the way that Mike Schur's other shows like Parks and Recreation are, where it's like genuine emotion for these characters because they're usually going through so many weird steps. But this one kind of had it all.
Dave, did you watch this mid-season finale?
I did.
What do you think?
I liked it.
As a diehard Lost fan, are we going to?
Well, I mean, I like it. I still don't think there is a good place. So wherever we end up at the end of the episode is a lie. But, well, because why would they be sending paperwork up there if nobody's been gone up there for years? It just seems like, anyway, not important. But I do think it's funny.
You don't see them send paperwork up there, though. You only see them send it to the bad place.
Well, right. But they send eventually all the people up there. The tube does go somewhere. I'm just saying it doesn't actually go to the good place.
Interesting.
But I also think it's funny that Patches is like, this is like a bottle episode. It takes place in the void. They hired two dozen puppies that need to be wrangled. So many actors that had lines or partial lines, which brings their day rate up. And the voyage exploded into cubes.
It's true. There are a lot of special effects in this episode.
Oh, and also there's an office full of people.
Yeah.
Some of which also
did
had
you mention
lines.
The puppies? There were a lot of puppies.
Yes. Oh, yes. And all those puppies had to be wrangled or at least digitally multiplied.
This is true.
So I think they hit their budget very well in a very good mid-season finale way. But I do like it. I kind of wish if I could change one thing that we did get the conclusion or this like big point of Eleanor and Chidi with the actual actors, because I still feel
but we
like
we did at the end.
No, I mean, I think we did at the end, but I still feel in terms of like a long-term story, I'm with Eleanor and why she likes Chidi. But in this episode at the beginning, I was sort of with Chidi, where I'm like, that's the person that the Chidi that loves Eleanor is not the one that's been manifested here. The Chidi we've been following all season was like more in love with the lady doctor, like back at the beginning of the season.
Oh, I miss
than
her.
He ever was with like Eleanor. So I was sort of like, I see why they had to get here for a mid-season finale, but I hope we return to that more. Because it worked really well to bring the void back together, but I don't buy it as a solution to the romance yet. I think we still have more of that to do this season.
Yeah, Katie, you had theories about Simone, right? Simone was his
fellow
neuroscientist,
like
she was going to be an angel in your mind, and it didn't. I do miss her, and I wonder.
Yeah, I miss her too.
I keep wondering, like, is this? I don't know. I guess we're so cynical and we have weird conversations online about the things that we love where I get skeptical if romance is the right direction for this. You know, should Chidi and Eleanor really be getting together? Is this a rom-com of sorts? Is the end of this about Chidi and Eleanor being in a stable relationship with one another? Is that
no,
okay?
I think we can like definitively say The Good Place is going to like include that, but that is not the end game of what it is going to be. It is obviously about so much more than that, and they keep trying to pivot and be about different things than you expect. So
right.
I don't expect it to go away, but I don't think it's going to be like Parks and Recreation where the goal was to get everyone, all the characters, to a place of a happy ending by the end.
But it's certainly, to be in a romance, the two of them have to accept the things that challenge them the most in their heads, you know, their neuroses or their shortcomings. And to be in love, Eleanor must have the capacity for love, believe in love in the first place. And Chidi has to, you know, believe in his ability to choose one thing in life. So I guess it speaks to something greater, but I hope, I don't know, it feels really authentic. And that's, I want to like this romance. And for some reason, I'm careful about
investing. If you want to like it, the best thing you could do, as I've learned from shipping many people throughout the TV series, is you don't want it at the forefront more. You want it at the background.
Leave it alone.
Yeah,
let the sitcom formula let them just continue it. But I think like The Good Place is all about philosophical arguments about if you could be a good person. So that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with being a couple. So I think let it be a good side plot to invest in these characters and care about them. But I wouldn't want it brought to the forefront. I don't want that to be the conclusion.
Well, I agree with you, Dave. I can't imagine they're in the good place, so I'm excited to see where they are now. And so we are telling you to catch up on The Good Place and tell us if you like it and if you're really into the romance. And I don't know. Let's just watch it. Let's have fun.
Be good people. Watch The Good Place.
So soon, later this month, we will be talking about our top tens, and as kind of a preface of that, I put a question out there to all of you that I want to hear your answers, and it might be too macro, too kooky, I don't know, it seems like a good podcast discussion. I'm not sure any of us could really write about this in a way that wouldn't embarrass us, but I'm sure we could talk about it in a way that, well, will still embarrass us, but at least we're in the safe space. So here's my question to you. We have had a whole year of movies, and this has been like the longest, shortest year of my life. It just, every day.
There's
something...
a whole podcast called that about parenthood patches, longest, shortest time.
Really? Well, yeah. I should probably listen to that, and I guess I'm onto something. That is a factor for me personally, but I just feel like every day there's something exaggerated, crazy happening. I keep mentioning my ongoing joke at work is like, did you know Black Panther came out this year? Because it just feels so long ago, and like we talk about that movie as some sort of legacy property of Marvel, but no, that was just February.
Do you know that the Winter Olympics were this year? That was the one that blew my mind. Like the Shib Sibs and Adam Rippon and all that? That was this year.
I remember the snowboarding and that little lady snowboarder who did a big cool trick.
Was this year.
This happened. Wow. So many movies, so many things. I wanted to hear from you guys. What movie is the most 2018? What? I don't know how you define 2018. That's part of this conversation, too, how you might look back at this year, how you're already looking back at this year. And then talk about what movie may encapsulate that for you. What movie, you know, over the years, we have talked about how difficult it is for films to capture the given moment because they take time to make. So it's hard for you to have to anticipate what's going on. And sometimes movies just get lucky to do that.
It's all luck. It's all the movie. It's the right movie comes along at the right time.
But that obviously, that's about taking the pulse and anticipating things. But maybe this movie that you're thinking of that encapsulates the year has nothing to do with that. So Katie, I'm going to put it to you first. What is the most 2018 movie based on whatever definition of 2018 you are using?
I mean, I'm going to start by saying that for the historical record, I think it is correct that Black Panther is going to be remembered as the movie of 2018 for many reasons that I'm sure we'll get into. But I wanted to make a modest proposal of The Death of Stalin, which I saw sometime at some point earlier this year when I think Trump had fired somebody and someone else in the White House was talking shit about that other person.
That could have been any week.
Literally any week. Yeah. And so if you want to sum up the year in terms of like being engaged in political news and watching all this White House, you know, palace intrigue, which I have spent a lot of time doing. The Death of Stalin is just such an amazing look at men in power and all the ridiculous, desperate things they do to hang on to that power and stay in the good graces of the person who is at the top of the heap at a given moment.
I don't understand how this is relevant.
Well, we're all powerless, so maybe it's harder to read from our end. But if you wanted to look at like this year feels like the year that has become so much more clear than ever before of how stupid and shameless power really is. And The Death of Stalin sums that up beautifully and really funny.
Do you think that The Death of Stalin, this film is from Armando Iannucci, who did Veep, who did
In the Loop.
What was his British TV show?
The
Thick of It, yes. He actually, during the press tour for The Death of Stalin, was asked, logically, I suppose, what he would do with Trump and if he could make a movie out of Trump. And I think actually later in the year, he signed a deal to do a Trump movie, which
really
seems pointless.
Anyone that is an Adam McKay?
Oh, David, we're going to get to this later in the segment. Don't worry. Iannucci thinks he could do a Trump movie. I'm not sure what you could possibly do and who would want to sit through this again. But I think you're right, Katie. The Death of Stalin is kind of a blunt force version of this. It's the darkness is what really strikes me about The Death of Stalin. Maybe someone can speak better to this, but it's not. Is it a comedy? Is it funny? Were you laughing?
So funny, yeah. And then it's incredibly dark. Like this, I mean, this is feels like when people were, I feel like Twitter was having this argument whether the Favorite is a comedy when it so abundantly is, even though it has maybe not quite as dark an ending, but similarly dark vibes at the end. Stories about people in power acting horribly can be really funny.
I think most movies
are funny.
I don't know I think a lot more movies than we tend to put under this umbrella could be classified as comedies. I think the movie that, I don't know if we're ready to segue to my pick for this question, but I think the movie that I would go to for the one that most summarizes how I feel to be alive in 2018 is one of the few I can think of from this year that in no way, shape, or form could be categorized as a comedy. By me, anyway. I'm sure someone could go through the mental gymnastics required to make it work. But should I go forward?
I think you've now segued.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
a Star Wars story.
It's a Star Wars solo, a Star Wars story. We can always go back to Katie's pick later in the segment. No, it's Paul Schrader's First Reformed, which is a movie that I actually first saw in September of 2017. And I liked quite a bit, but it really... what struck me about the movie was how over the course of 2018, it stayed with me in a way that no other movie that I had seen recently had. It really clung to my bones. And as my despair grew and shrunk and then grew again, even to higher heights, time and again, I returned to First Reformed, which is a movie that I don't know if we've talked about on the podcast before, but yeah, it's not a comedy is the long and short of it. About Ethan Hawke as a ailing priest in upstate New York who is also in mourning a son who died in the Iraq War and is having a very, very pronounced crisis of faith. And then he begins spiraling when he tries to counsel a young man who is about to become a father who is very afraid of climate change and has all the statistics to back up his fears. And a character like Reverend Ernst Toller, who is spiraling himself to begin with and in desperate need of a vessel to contain and give shape and grandiosity to his feelings that he already has, becomes similarly attached to climate change in a way, and it goes out of control from there. And I think the climate change of it all, which is really just a means to an end in this movie, is very real for me, for all of us. And all the articles I read this year about climate change, particularly that big one that was in the New York Times Magazine, I believe, it was like, yes, this is First Reform.
We all mean the one I never read because I was too afraid.
That
exactly.
Was
it's like we all feel like Reverend Ernst Toller in a way, but at the same time, here, you know, we are not quite at the point, at least the four of us, it seems, of throwing in the towel and calling it a day on this earth, our lives, etc., as grim as things are. You know, we are – Katie is about to have another kid and, you know, we
First
are all –
made me wonder how good an idea that was.
Yeah, well, it's a movie. It's a question that is asked explicitly in the movie about bringing a child into this world. But I think – even though the ending of the movie could be read in many different ways, I think one of the interpretations that I take away from the movie is sort of about trucking on and finding, like, celebrating life and even in the face of such insurmountable odds, and the idea that the very real crystallization of a feeling that every previous generation has had, that we are sort of at the end times, but it's more real for us, and finding a way to persevere in spite of that.
Is that
and
how
I
you...
Think,
I mean,
it, I think
pretty
it
far
captures
out from
what
this
it's
film.
Like to be alive right now.
And I
What's
feel
that?
Like we could – I said I feel like we're far out from this film. You can – I think you can watch First Reformed on Amazon Prime now. I think you can
It's definitely this. Available somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to ask you about the ending, David. Is that – I mean, is that how you feel about the end, that it's actually an optimistic ending in a way?
I do.
The ending is very ambiguous,
I think that it's possible to reconcile a positive read on the ending with – Paul Schrader's stated belief that this is the last century for humanity. I mean, I don't know if I necessarily believe that. I certainly share his fears. But I think even he, in a way that dovetails with the themes of the movies in a larger way, can see how those two things can coexist. But I, the first time I saw this movie, I didn't even entertain the idea, that it could not be taken literally, that if we're going to speak in detail, if you haven't seen First Reformed, stop listening right now. But I, the first time I saw this movie, took at face value that Reverend Ernst Toller was about to kill himself, and Amanda Seyfried came in, and he saw her, and he saw a release for all of the fear and hopelessness that had been building up with him. It wasn't obviously going to be simple, but it was like a moment of ineffable grace, a divine revelation of some kind that he experiences and is able to sort of unblock these passages for him and point a path of light forward. And I have – listening to other people talk about the movie, revisiting the movie, I see now that there is definitely room for interpretation, that this is all sort of in his head, that he did in fact drink the Drano. The sounds of her footsteps entering the room have been cut out of the movie to entertain both sides of that reading. So you can watch it and just feel as if she just appears. But yeah, I think – I mean I don't really – I choose – my reading of the movie dovetails with the former interpretation that I think that – in spite of everything and everything that is said about climate change in this movie is regrettably true. And the hopelessness, the despair that the character is feeling before we even meet him and he hears about all of this stuff firsthand. I still think that they're, it's almost our duty as shepherds of this earth to find a positive way forward. Those of us who can, not that I'm going to assume this for myself, but a character like Ernst Toller who can see the grimness, see the darkness, and then find a sliver of light and follow that. I think that there's something true there, but I just think like the roller coaster between despair and hope is very accurate to my experience.
I'm laughing because I know how Katie feels about the First Reformed.
I mean, do we want me to yell about the ending of First Reform now? No, I know it's going to come up.
Do you want to talk about that in our top 10 episode where,
I will just say briefly, I find the idea that setting up all of these very true things you're saying about finding despair in the world and wondering about things and then presenting as the avenue for salvation, simply an idealized blonde woman named Mary who's going to solve all of your problems.
It's despite symbolic.
Having no personality traits of her own. I know it's still obnoxious.
It's supposed to symbolize Taylor Swift. Paul Schrader loves Taylor Swift.
Although I would take issue with the idea or the characterization that she has no traits of her own. I've watched the movie twice this week. Once.
Jesus.
Once just because I was like, should I drink the Drano? And once because.
And then you drank the Pepto and whiskey instead.
Right. Yeah. There are a lot of great cocktails in this movie. And once because I was doing a Q&A with Ethan Hawke and needed to just refresh and wanted to find some new questions. Ethan Hawke is a blast to talk to about this movie, as you might expect. But I do think that Amanda Seyfried's character is a flesh and blood human. She has a lot of conflicting emotions that are given real weight in the story about how she wants to proceed her own agency over her husband's and how they were perpendicular with one another, and the friction that it caused in her marriage and the way that it left her feeling afterwards. I think all this stuff is very well articulated in the movie and real, and part of the reason why it just made me more comfortable with the ending, regardless of your interpretation of it. Because I thought that she needed Reverend Toller as much as he needed her.
I think it's hopeful. I think it's – and to speak to our larger point of this segment, not to get too like quarter quelly here, but the year for me is hopeful. If there's some sort of like long-term message to all this, it's that we're seeing the reality of the world, the harsh reality, and hopefully also the people we know and love in it. And like Katie, you kind of glibly mentioned – oh, should I be having another kid in this world? I've seen so much of that sentiment this year. It's unbelievable. It's a hard thing to read when you just had a kid. And I just push back against that so much. Like, I'm glad I had a kid. I'm glad I brought a kid in this crazy world. I love this kid and I love the people I love. And that's what gets you through this fucking mess. And at the end of the day, First Reformed is the pendulum swing from the most harsh, strife of the world all the way to something that people cannot even fathom as realistic, the embrace at the end. But it's just like, yeah, that's what this year is all about, trying to make it through it all.
If you want to see a movie that grapples with whether or not it's right to have a kid in this world and what it means, see Private Life.
You can see them both.
No, only one.
Private Life is another great movie.
I was gonna say my movie of the year might be Tully, but that might be too intimate. Dave, is it
too close to home?
What's your movie of 20?
Yes, I don't have a child. I'm not married. I work for a reality TV series that's renewed seasonally. I'm actually going to change my answer because hearing your prompt at the top of the segment made me realize my answer was not what I thought it was. What movie am I going to think about in terms of 2018? I'm going to think about Sorry to Bother You, since Katie didn't pick it.
That's a good answer. I would have picked
that. We're all already the horse people, guys. That's what this year taught us.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Spoiler?
What? No, yes, we should spoil because people... Yeah, well, first off, people should see Sorry to Bother You. Yeah, it's on Hulu now.
It's available.
It's available. You should see it. It's a Boots Riley rapper directorial debut. It has Lakeith Stanfield. It has Tessa Thompson. It has Danny Glover. It has Armie Hammer.
It has Steven Yeun.
It has Steven Yeun. It has some great things to say about, late stage capitalism and race, amongst other things. I still think, Java and I, when we saw this movie, had a discussion about what Tessa Thompson's character was trying to accomplish with her ridiculous art piece. And I still enjoy sometimes coming up with new ridiculous things she could have been saying about it. I think this movie has so much going on and so many themes that by the time it gets to Horse People, you're sort of
horse
on,
people.
You're on its level, Horse People, and labor strikes. You're on its level so much that it leaves you, after the movie, the actual socialist themes of it sneak in. I think it's such a fun and smart way to have a really smart theme served to you so ridiculously that everything sort of comes in it. It's like the Animal Farm equivalent of 2018, and we're all the horse people already.
God,
but, I mean,
no,
we could still rise up, but we're still the horse people.
Why do you think we're the horse people already?
Why do I think we're the horse people already? So I've been.
And maybe put it in terms of this movie, because if you haven't seen it, but you're listening for spoilers, you may not have any idea what the hell Dave's talking about.
Sure. So recently, we're going to get new gigantic Amazon centers in, say, like New York and Virginia.
Yeah.
And
just
these
to
are,
mention two random cities that you pulled out of a hat. Yeah.
And as Saturday Night Live, for instance, presented this as Steve Carell as Jeff Bezos, mocking how he was like rich enough to troll Trump and be in both of his backyards, when the reality is that this is a huge multinational company that cares so much about shipping you things fast that cities are giving gigantic tax breaks to these companies that are providing not great working conditions for not excellent pay. And we want them. We want them bad, because they're Amazon and they're huge. And the fact that everybody's okay with this, even though, I don't know, Foxconn is going to build a plant in Michigan.
Wisconsin.
There's the latest episode of the Reply All podcast gets into the nitty gritty of that process. It's very interesting.
Yeah, they spent basically like $100,000 per job and gave it to China to get something like that.
Mm-hmm. To get jobs that are going to pay like
$50,000
per year on average.
The Trumpsters who made it happen.
Yep.
So point being, because it's 2018 and we did not have an election, we are by default the horse people. I'm happy that, our presidential election. I'm happy that in our, midterm election, we are, kind of revolting like horse people, but that doesn't, that doesn't mean that we're not horse people already. We're sort of already there.
Yeah,
that's right.
Well, I hope
you shouldn't let
up.
Me go after the, like, depend on love people. Well, I guess we still have patches.
No, we gotta get
patches.
Fired up.
Yeah. I think it's important to be angry. The whole idea, sort of, sorry to bother you, is being complicit and making sure that your ends can meet eventually feeds into the very system, power structure system, that puts you in that hole you had to get out of in the first place.
But you mentioning that SNL bit with Steve Carell as Jeff Bezos reminds me that I think at some point, I this is probably something you've talked about in your other podcasts or we don't need to be the authority on it, but at some point, as someone who, for whatever reason, has watched just about every episode of SNL this year, we need to talk about SNL.
Good Lord, David.
I know.
David it's is switching his answer to all of SNL. That's what his
No.
All the complete work of Colin Jost.
No. We need to talk about SNL.
I just brought that up, and specifically, like, we're in such a bad position that we're like, look at this billionaire who donates a fraction of 1% of his billions of dollars.
Right.
To okay causes.
But
and
that
he's
bit,
sticking it to the orange guy. Isn't that worthwhile? No, yeah. It's not.
Anyone celebrating Jeff Bezos, we're sticking it to Trump as an idiot.
Right. That bit so missed the mark that I thought it was just a glaring indication of how irrelevant and in the not unhelpful SNL has been this season. I think we should talk about it at some point. The future segment, future episode.
Can I say another aside about Sorry to Bother You?
Yes.
Yeah. Sure.
I realized after watching it, this is the first thing I'd actually seen Steven Yeun in, because I don't watch The Walking Dead and I haven't yet seen Burning. And he's great. And I was like, oh, huh. I thought I knew his work because I just heard about him for so long. But yes, wait, super impressed.
Wait, you never saw Okja?
Oh, yeah, no, I never saw Okja. Yeah, sorry, that's the other one. I never managed to see Okja. So, yeah, he's super hot in this movie, too.
You never watched
saw I, Origins?
You guys just both said things that I definitely have not seen.
You didn't see the episode of The Big Bang Theory, The Staircase Implementation, in which he played the role of Sebastian?
Are you looking at IMDb?
I know that offhand. It's one of
He's a very handsome man.
And super handsome. And in this movie, because like Lakeith Stanfield is also a very handsome man. And for you to like buy that, because like he and Tessa Thompson have this real connection in the beginning of the movie. And for you to buy that Steven Yeun could be a real threat, like he's got to really give it. And he gives it.
Well, I hope we talk about Burning.
Wait till you see Burning.
Well, I might mention it in a second here.
Burning is your pick?
I might have to like wind my way around that. And it's definitely recency bias because I just watched Burning this past week. But I got to mention, well, first off, we're not all horse people. I started a union this year. So me and Steve Ewan are equally hot.
You're the horse people at the very, very end of the movie who are revolting.
Yeah. You started a union and got scared of a crowd with a whole bunch of American flags just because you didn't know why they were there. So you're a horse.
You need to do like a comic panel reference to an old episode with that. I want to mention two movies here. And one I want to speed through. David, are we allowed to talk about Vice?
I don't know. I know that the social embargo has been listed, but I don't think that we're really allowed to get into the nitty gritty until whenever. I'm not sure when the embargo is.
I'm not sure either. But
sometime in the new year is when they'd prefer you to talk about
Vice. I won't talk.
They'd
about
prefer
the
me to
Vice.
Talk about Vice. You know, sometime after I'm dead.
I will not talk about Adam McKay's Vice, which is a Christian Bale-led Dick Cheney biopic. But I will talk in the abstract about a film like that. About how I think in 2018 we have such fire for the things that we hate, the people that we hate, the politics that we hate, necessarily so because there are clear enemies and we know that they've done great wrongs, but that in 2018 everyone is completely spiraling out of control. And for me, a movie potentially like Vice, who knows, could be. I don't know. Does anyone follow Adam McKay on Twitter or Facebook?
I do not.
Follow him on Twitter, but
I don't know why I do either. But it's about anger. I don't know if you guys feel similarly that, you know, the resistance is its own extremism. The way we invest in the Mueller investigation or something like that, the way we invest in the pushback against all the things that we hate, how everyone is drunk on everything, not to say that all these things are equal, but I look at this very political movie that's about to come out, and it just seems so misguided in the way that it's attacking and lampooning, and it feels very 2018 to me in how dunking is the new rhetoric of even the people I agree with. It's just 2018 is a dizzying moment.
Is this a Pod Save America subtweet again?
Well, I would never subtweet Pod Save America. I don't listen to Pod Save America. We've talked about that on this podcast. I've moved beyond the subtweet. I just don't listen to it because I can't stand it. But I don't know. Maybe we can't talk about Vice. But does that sentiment make any sense? I mean, if you were to talk about SNL, that's the same kind of thing. It's like SNL thinks it's dunking, but it's out of control and extreme, and it's disillusioned. It has no.
I wouldn't say that this is the year of dunking. I would say this is the year of like. Completely misconstruing what is a dunk to make over dunk things. So like
the over dunk.
Whoa.
Yeah. So like
post dunk.
It feels like making fun of Dick Cheney this year in a movie that you wrote and directed with Christian Bale in it is sort of like low hanging fruit, considering this week the New York District Attorney might have insinuated the president directed somebody to commit a felony.
But Dave, what if you made a movie that had the vision, the balls, the insight to say that Dick Cheney is bad.
His long history.
Right. It's the appearance of a dunk when I think it's just been, it's like a slow burn elevated to a dunk status. But like, I feel like the big things that happen or that have happened this year it's like a delayed reaction and has to like ripple through all of society, and we still have to be talking about it like 2 months later for it to really feel like a dunk. That makes any sort of sense?
I think you're onto something. I think we're on the same page.
Well, there's something about the Trump administration where like so much crazy shit happens all the time, and like dunking is kind of like the most obvious thing you can do. Like the fact that you can't just look back and be like, wow, it's really crazy that the president is an unindicted co-conspirator in all of these crimes. Like that just feels so beside the point to talk about. It makes the territory for actual dunks really small because there's so much
right
there.
Yeah. So like it's used to be like if you, I don't know, you watch the old clip of like Jon Stewart going on Crossfire and being like, not you're telling people lies, but you're bad for America for making this partisan issue. If that were to happen today, no one would bat an eye because the government's just lying to us now
right,
and like provably lying to us.
Yeah.
And so if I come back with like the sickest of burns on a Donald Trump retweet, which I, you know, sometimes in the morning attempt to do out of foolhardiness and then delete, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, because he's self-care. By the time you wake up, he tweeted like 7 hours earlier at 5 a.m. right. Eastern.
I think that falls into the category of self-care, where sometimes you just got to vent in order to stay sane.
Right, but I mean, I'm not going to make a movie about Dick Cheney to vent.
well, yeah.
That's like what it all feels like to me.
And,
yeah. We'll get there. I think when we are coast clear to talk about Vice, we can dig into that a little bit more. But I did want to mention, because I brought this up earlier in the segment, I want to mention Burning. And I don't know, much like Burning, the film by Li Chengdong, that it went from theaters, it seems like, but should be out, available to rent, hopefully soon.
I think it did pretty well by Art House, independent, you know, foreign film standards.
Well, I'm excited to hear that. I hope people will find this film. It is absolutely beautiful. We will end up talking about it in the top tens, I think. So I don't want to belabor it here.
David, it made $450,000.
Yeah. Okay.
Which, you know, for a Well-Go USA movie is pretty great.
I don't know about that. Some of their international action
movies. Oh, yeah. Some of their movies that they're able to, they're like the big Chinese blockbusters they import.
But this is come to Netflix. Well-Go movies usually come to Netflix. So
yeah. And this is a pretty good performance for a 2.5 hour Korean art movie
about nothing. Yes.
In 2018.
We're about everything. This movie is based on a short story by Haruki Murakami, and it certainly feels like it. If you've ever read, a lot of people have read Wind Up Bird Chronicle. Feels like that book. It's one of the only.
It's the only movie that has ever captured.
Like, yes, absolutely.
What his writing is,
you know,
like.
From like talking about wells to sitting around drinking beers and listening to music. I mean, it is absolutely Murakami, 100%. Why is this a 2018 movie? I was thinking about in our 150th episode. Holy shit! From February 7th, 2017. Holy shit! I talked about Cachet as a movie that I thought represented America, or the America I wanted, that was kind of like intrusively making people aware of their prejudices and reckoning with their past. And it was not the kind of obvious parallel, but I saw some connections there. And Burning, maybe the 2018 movie, it's definitely sticking with me in just terms of like meditating on images, reflecting on life, taking... I feel like in 2018, and maybe you guys disagree, we're just like, because we live so much life every single day, how social media stuffs everything down our throats, how every movement of the needle, the political needle, is life or death. We just see the end so close, and yet we have no idea what the end is. Burning is a very abstract, amorphous movie that on its surface is kind of a mystery. The main character is trying to find this woman that he's met, this woman from his past, and she has disappeared. And Steven Yeun is in this film as well. He might be creeping. He's kind of like a talented Mr. Ripley type almost. He's extremely suave, and our main character is not. He wants to be a writer. He...
say no more.
Yeah, we all know that struggle. Very real, and we all want to be Steven Yeun. But I can't quite put my finger on how I feel like this movie is everything that's happening in this world.
Male rage, class anxiety.
It just touches on everything, all the extremes that we feel in the world, and that, you know, all of the mortal sins that we can commit, envy being one of them, just like how we want to get ahead, how we don't, how we fail, how we struggle, what we want in this world, what this world, we expect this world to be, and how sometimes we don't give a shit what happened before in the past, and we're only looking forward, and sometimes we're completely dwelling in the past and not looking forward at all, and then we crash into something. I don't know. Who has seen this movie? David has seen this movie.
Oh, David has seen this movie.
David has absorbed this movie. He has lived to breathe this movie. He's seen it 18 times, probably.
I have LARPed this movie.
Am I on to anything here? Is Burning like a 2018 movie, even though it's 2.5 hours long, very little happens, and, you know, we're looking at pictures of the world burning.
That describes me, like, reading Twitter to follow any Trump story this year.
It was two and a half hours
doing it, and nothing happened.
Schlubby writer who wants to be Steven Yeun.
And you call out to a cat that may or may not be there. Or in your case, Schlubby. Hedgehog.
Now we're just hurling insults. As a hedgehog. It's getting oddly personal. No, I think that the boiling, impotent male rage that drives this movie is very real, and we see it take a number of violent forms, as it does in some ways in this movie. I think that the class struggle, the apathy that comes from the top, the rage that comes from the bottom, the sense of a disequilibrium is all very 2018 and very real and urgent and present. I think that this is very much a movie that speaks to our moment, and even, you know, in a literal geopolitical sense, touches on the relationship between North Korea and the rest of the world, particularly South Korea. I mean, that's very specific relative to the rest of what we're talking about. But the most memorable scene from this movie, it takes place right in the shadow of the DMZ. And they can hear the sirens from North Korea blaring over propaganda messages. And I feel like, you know, that's something you can apply pretty directly to our experience in America whenever a television is playing Fox News in the background.
So, and the airport.
Or any fucking airport. What the fuck? What the fuck? Tom Cruise should make a fucking video with Chris McQuarrie about how when you're in an airport and you see a television, you should turn off the motion smoothing, the interpolation, and then also change the fucking channel.
I don't think you're allowed. Can you change the channel in the
TSA
airport?
TSA going to throw you in jail?
No, you'll absolutely get arrested by TSA. They'll find you.
All right.
Oh, no.
On that note, we've recommended some movies to watch that will make you think. Go think.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week with a regular episode. As hinted several times throughout this, our top 10s episode is coming. I've really enjoyed the tweets of people who are predicting what the top 10s episode is going to be like.
Yeah, mine are really difficult to imagine, but
what your top 10s are going to be. Just delete your memory of whatever David may have put out there from mine and prepare to be surprised. Or also maybe he'll have changed his mind and put Mary Poppins Returns in the
number. Please rewatch.
I reserve the right. Mary Poppins Returns 1, Vice 2. We'll
Aquaman 3.
Jurassic
Aquaman
World 3. Fallen Kingdom Rewatch.
Mortal Engines 4. I'm going heavy.
Slenderman.
In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Twitter at Patches. We have a website, fightingthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes, share them with friends. You can predict their top 10s, but not David's. Anything is possible at fightingthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and on IndieWire at IndieWire.com. Writing about Mary Poppins Returns. You can find all of us together on Facebook. It's not just for funding genocides. It's also for promoting podcasts like ours, where you can find us on Fighting in the War.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA70. I'll be posting any Spider-Verse writing I do on that. Also, make sure to tune into this week's Storm of Spoilers, where I was just like a few hours after seeing Into the Spider-Verse. I basically monologue about it for an hour and a half. You know what? If that's for you, you know already. Look me up at Storm of Spoilers.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com. And there on the podcast, Little Gold Men, where we're talking about all of the awards that keep getting nominated and nominees and awards and critics prizes that are being handed out in the last few weeks. There's a lot to keep track of. Also, we talked about Kevin Hart last week before he quit, but you might get some insight on why he should have quit. Anyway, go find Little Gold Men. It's a good time to subscribe. You can find us for Fighting in the War Room. Okay, I'm on Twitter, Katie Ridge, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where, again, we enjoy hearing your predictions for the Top 10s episode, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Once Upon a Deadpool, what R-rated movie is just some added bookended scenes away from needing a PG-13 cut?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. Can't stop me now!